So picture this. It's 2002. The United States Congress passes a piece of legislation, and it theoretically authorizes the president to use military force against, of all places, one of America's oldest, most strategically vital allies.
Right, which sounds completely wild out of context.
Totally wild.
Yeah.
I mean, the target wasn't a rogue state or, you know, some sudden military threat. The target was the Netherlands.
Yeah, the Netherlands.
And the justification for this, it was to authorize the mobilization of the American military to literally bust U.S. personnel out of a prison cell in The Hague.
Which is just a staggering flex of, well, hegemonic power.
Exactly. It was a warning shot, but fired not with artillery, but with domestic law. And the reason we're bringing this up today is that we're looking at a brand new policy that basically takes that underlying hostility, dusts it off, and turns it into an active, globally coordinated war against the International Criminal Court.
Yeah, the historical echo here is just deafening. I mean, we're witnessing this massive transition from a posture of sort of protective isolationism into one of aggressive dismantlement.
Right.
Because for decades, the United States maintained this really delicate, maybe sometimes hypocritical, but generally stable equilibrium with the international legal architecture.
A balancing act.
Exactly. And that equilibrium, it just completely collapsed.
Which is exactly what we're going to explore in today's deep dive. So welcome back, everyone. We are looking at a massive geopolitical shockwave that honestly just hit the wires this morning, July 14th, 2026.
It's been a busy morning.
Oh, it really has. The Trump administration has officially announced its intent to use, quote, all available means to cripple the ICC in The Hague.
Right.
And to really understand the mechanics of this, our mission today is to unpack a very specific, highly relevant document. We're looking at Chapter 804 from the Trump dossier, 2015-2029.
Which is a fascinating text.
It really is. Now, before we get into the weeds of treaty law and, you know, the massive geopolitical fallout, we do need to establish a very clear baseline for you, the listener.
Yeah, this is crucial.
Because this involves highly charged political actions. We're talking about deeply held convictions about sovereignty, justice, military power. So our objective today is strictly analytical.
We're not taking a side here.
Exactly. We're entirely impartial guides today. We're not endorsing the viewpoints of the administration, and we're not endorsing the perspectives of the court's defenders either.
Right. We're just laying it out.
We are strictly breaking down the exact arguments from both sides as they're outlined in the source material and really just exploring this immense clash between national sovereignty and international law.
And, you know, the value of this specific chapter in the dossier is its clinical detachment. It doesn't treat the administration's announcement as some sudden anomaly, but really as the logical terminus of a legal philosophy that's been brewing in Washington for, gosh, a quarter century now.
Right. It's not out of nowhere.
No, not at all. And to understand what the administration is threatening to do today, we really have to understand the specific legal mechanics of how a sovereign state actually attacks an international institution.
So let's get into those mechanics, because we've seen the U.S. throw its diplomatic weight around before.
Yeah.
I mean, previous administrations have used the U.N. Security Council veto to shield themselves or their allies.
Sure, that's standard practice.
Right. Or they've issued sternly worded statements of non-cooperation. But the strategy detailed in this July 2026 announcement, it fundamentally shifts the battlefield.
It really does.
The administration isn't just refusing to cooperate anymore. They are actively seeking to dismantle the court's operational capacity, and they're doing it through this dense web of targeted sanctions against ICC staff.
And the application of those sanctions, that's where this moves from, you know, standard diplomatic posturing to an existential threat for the court itself.
How so? Like, mechanically?
Well, the U.S. is basically weaponizing its position at the absolute center of the global financial system. So by designating ICC judges, prosecutors, even administrative staff under sanctions regimes that are typically reserved for, like, terrorists or rogue states, the administration effectively cuts them out of the modern world.
So it's a bit like someone refusing to pay a parking ticket from a neighboring town because they just don't recognize that town's authority, right?
Okay.
But on a massive, heavily armed global scale, or, you know, a better analogy might be cutting the structural cables of a suspension bridge.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
You don't have to fly a bomber over the bridge to destroy it. If you simply sever the flow of capital, restrict the travel of the engineers, and, you know, freeze the bank accounts of anyone who tries to pour concrete, the bridge just collapses under its own weight.
That is exactly it. Because if a prosecutor in The Hague cannot use a credit card that touches a U.S. clearinghouse, or if a judge's family can't secure travel visas, the institution literally cannot function.
It's paralyzed.
Exactly. And that bridge cables analogy perfectly illustrates the asymmetry of this conflict.
Yeah.
You have to remember, the ICC has no police force, it has no financial clearinghouses, it has no territory of its own.
Right. It's completely reliant on others.
Entirely. It relies entirely on the voluntary cooperation and the financial plumbing of its member states. So when the United States leverages, say, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, to target a foreign judge, it forces every international bank, every airline, every tech company to make a choice.
A choice between what? Facilitating the court or?
Facilitating an international court or retaining access to the U.S. dollar. And for a multinational corporation, that is no choice at all. They will comply with Washington every single time.
Every time, yeah. But to really understand the mindset that leads to weaponizing OFAC against a judge, we have to look backward. Right. The dossier points out that this aggressive posture isn't entirely unprecedented. It has a legislative grandfather.
It does.
And that takes us back to that 2002 legislation I mentioned at the top, American Service Members Protection Act, or ASMPA.
Yes. Passed in the immediate, just hyper-securitized aftermath of 9/11. The political climate of 2002 is crucial context here. The United States was launching a global war on terror. They were deploying forces to multiple theaters around the world. And the primary anxiety in Washington at that time was the prospect of American soldiers or intelligence officers being subjected to politically motivated prosecutions by this newly minted international court.
And the text of the ASMPA is fascinatingly aggressive. I mean, this is the law critics famously dubbed the Hague Invasion Act.
Such a wild nickname.
It really is. It explicitly authorized the president to use, quote, all means necessary and appropriate to bring about the release of any U.S. or allied personnel being detained by or on behalf of the ICC.
Which is just, yeah, incredible language.
You mentioned earlier that the diplomatic shockwaves of this were massive.
Yeah.
How did European capitals, particularly the Dutch, react to a NATO ally formally authorizing a hypothetical military incursion into their sovereign territory? I mean, that's their land.
Well, the European reaction was this bizarre mixture of profound diplomatic outrage and, frankly, cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because the Netherlands, as you noted, is a founding member of NATO. It hosts the court. So for the U.S. Congress to codify language suggesting an armed extraction from a Dutch detention center, it felt like a deep betrayal of the whole transatlantic security architecture.
Just a slap in the face.
Exactly. European diplomats viewed it as a gross overreaction. However, and this is important, they also understood the domestic American political reality.
Which is what?
That the U.S. views its military personnel through a very unique, very protective lens of national sovereignty.
Okay, so the ASMPA established this legislative foundation for hostility. It essentially said, we do not recognize your authority and we will literally use force to reject it.
Yes.
But, I mean, there's a massive leap from passing a hypothetical extraction law in 2002 to actively sanctioning judges in 2026.
Oh, definitely.
So let's talk about the ideological clash, because the dossier outlines a very specific set of arguments the Trump administration is using to justify this massive escalation. They're building a deeply structured legal case for why the ICC is fundamentally illegitimate in its current form.
Right. And the administration's argument really rests on a trifecta of legal and political principles. Mm-hmm. The first one is a strict interpretation of treaty law.
Okay.
The United States never ratified the 2002 Rome Statute. Therefore, they argue, the institution has absolutely zero jurisdiction over American citizens. Period.
Wait, I need to pause you on the contract law aspect here, because this is a sticking point that I think often confuses people.
Sure.
The administration argues you can't be bound by a treaty you didn't sign. But look at it this way. If a U.S. citizen travels to Paris and, you know, commits a crime, they're arrested by French police and they're tried under French law, not U.S. law.
Exactly.
France doesn't need America's permission to prosecute a crime committed on French soil.
Mm.
So why is the ICC any different? How does the ICC claim jurisdiction over an American if America isn't in the club?
That is the exact crux of the jurisdictional dispute right there.
Yeah.
So the ICC operates on what is called delegated territorial jurisdiction.
Okay, delegated.
Right. Let's use Afghanistan as the classic example here, since they are a member of the ICC. If a U.S. soldier allegedly commits a war crime on Afghan territory, the ICC argues that Afghanistan has the sovereign right to prosecute that crime.
Because it happened on their land.
Exactly. Furthermore, Afghanistan has the sovereign right to delegate that prosecution to the ICC. So the court argues it is merely exercising the territorial jurisdiction that its member state willingly handed over.
I see. So the court is saying, we aren't asserting jurisdiction over America. We are asserting Afghanistan's jurisdiction over an event that happened on their land, and they just asked us to handle it.
Precisely the argument. However, the U.S. constitutional counterargument, and this is a uniquely American legal posture, is that a sovereign nation cannot delegate criminal jurisdiction over a non-consenting third-party citizens to an unaccountable supranational body.
Wow. Okay. That's a dense legal argument.
It is. Washington argues that, yes, while a U.S. soldier might be subject to domestic Afghan law in theory, Afghanistan cannot outsource that soldier's trial to a tribunal in Europe that the U.S. government explicitly rejected.
Which brings us directly to the second pillar of the administration's argument.
Right.
The principle of complementarity.
Yes, exactly.
This is a term that gets thrown around constantly in these debates, but the actual mechanism of it is critical. The U.S. argues that it has a robust, highly developed military justice system that is perfectly capable of handling its own affairs.
Right. And the Rome Statute was explicitly designed as a court of last resort. Article 17 of the treaty dictates this complementarity principle. It states that the ICC cannot take a case if a national jurisdiction is already investigating or prosecuting it.
Unless.
No?
Unless the national jurisdiction is doing a fake job of it, right?
Right, exactly. The legal standard they use is unwilling or unable to genuinely carry out the investigation. And this is where the friction really ignites.
Because who decides what's genuine?
Exactly. The United States argues that its Uniform Code of Military Justice is the gold standard, and that any internal U.S. investigation, even one that results in a dismissal or an acquittal, fulfills that complementarity requirement.
So they're saying, we investigated, we're done.
Right. The U.S. position is that the ICC has absolutely no right to second-guess the outcome of an American military tribunal.
But the ICC prosecutors have historically argued that sometimes those internal investigations are, you know, inherently flawed.
Yeah.
Or maybe designed to shield high-ranking officials from accountability.
Yes.
So how exactly does the ICC legally determine if a domestic court is unwilling or unable? Like, what is the threshold for a prosecutor in The Hague to look at a sovereign nation and declare its justice system a sham?
Well, it is a highly subjective and politically fraught legal test. The ICC assesses whether proceedings were undertaken specifically for the purpose of shielding the person from criminal responsibility, or if there was an unjustified delay, or if the proceedings just weren't conducted independently or impartially.
That's a lot of subjective judgment.
It is. And when a prosecutor in The Hague applies that test to the United States, literally evaluating classified military investigations and determining they are insufficient, it is viewed by Washington as an intolerable violation of sovereignty.
Which feeds perfectly into the third, and frankly, I think the most potent political argument the administration makes, democratic accountability.
Definitely the most resonant for the public.
Right, because if a democracy elects its leaders, and those leaders appoint its judges, there is a clear, unbroken chain of accountability back to the voter.
Yes.
The administration argues that foreign judges lack any democratic link to the American public.
It's what the dossier outlines as the Staatsrechtliche or constitutional approach.
Right.
In the American legal tradition, the Constitution is the absolute apex of all authority. Surrendering jurisdiction to a panel of judges, some of whom might even hail from countries without independent judiciaries or robust democratic traditions, is seen as a massive breach of the fundamental social contract.
He's just a non-starter.
Exactly. The American government's primary directive is to protect the constitutional rights of its citizens, not to offer them up to a foreign court whose procedures differ vastly from U.S. due process.
And I can see how that argument resonates powerfully with a domestic audience.
Mm.
I mean, it is incredibly clean, right?
Mm-mm.
Unelected foreign bureaucrats should not have the power to imprison American citizens.
Very clean. Very effective.
But the dossier meticulously details the counterarguments from the international community.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the people who drafted the Rome Statute anticipated this exact tension. So how do defenders of the ICC respond to this sort of sovereignty absolutism?
Well, the counter perspective is anchored in the international rechtelik, or international law, approach.
Okay.
Critics of the U.S. policy argue that the American insistence on absolute sovereignty essentially hollows out the entire post-WWII legal order. The fundamental premise of international law is that certain crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, are so egregious that they transcend national borders. They concern the international community as a whole.
And if a superpower just exempts itself from that framework, the framework collapses.
Right. The argument is that you cannot have rules-based order if the rules only apply to the weak.
Yeah.
If the United States demands that the ICC aggressively pursue, say, Russian generals or African warlords, but simultaneously threatens to sanction the court if it looks at an American or an ally, it creates a codified two-tiered system of global justice.
It's kind of like the geopolitical equivalent of a billionaire insisting on strict tax enforcement for the middle class, right?
Right.
While simultaneously storing all their wealth in an untouchable offshore trust. It just breeds deep structural cynicism about the fairness of the whole system.
And that cynicism leaves smaller nations incredibly vulnerable. Because for many states, international law is the only shield they have against aggression.
Right. They don't have massive militaries.
Exactly. If major powers refuse to be bound by universal norms, that protective shield evaporates. Defenders of the court argue that democratic accountability cannot be used as an absolute shield for impunity, especially when the victims of the alleged crimes are often stateless or belong to nations whose justice systems have been completely destroyed by the conflict in question.
Wow. So we really have this massive philosophical divide here. One side prioritizes the consent of the governed and the primacy of the national constitution above all else.
Yes.
And the other side prioritizes a universal standard of human rights that supersedes national borders. And for a long time, the world kind of awkwardly managed this tension. But this rigid stance on sovereignty doesn't just exist in a vacuum. It gets truly complicated and honestly highly volatile when the U.S. applies this logic to its allies.
Which brings us to the next massive piece of this puzzle.
Right. Let's look at how the administration justifies stretching this protective umbrella over Israel, because the dossier makes it very clear this is a central catalyst for the July 2026 announcement.
It absolutely is. The timing and severity of the U.S. policy are intrinsically linked to the ICC's ongoing investigations into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Right.
The court has been navigating a legal minefield in that region for years, examining allegations against both Israeli forces and Palestinian militant groups.
And the legal mechanics of how the ICC even got involved there are pretty complex, right? Because Israel, just like the U.S., never ratified the Rome Statute.
They did not. However, the Palestinian Authority formally acceded to the Rome Statute.
Oh.
And this triggered a massive years-long legal battle over statehood recognition. But ultimately, the court ruled that it possessed territorial jurisdiction over Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And this provided the legal avenue for the prosecutor to actually open investigations.
And the U.S. administration's reaction to that, as highlighted in the dossier, is uncompromising.
Very much so.
They view the ICC's assertion of jurisdiction over Israeli personnel not as a pursuit of justice, but as a blatantly political weaponization of the court against a key strategic ally. Like, it's a team captain not only arguing a referee's call against themselves, but demanding the referee be fired for calling a foul on their star teammate.
That's a great way to put it. The U.S. argument here really just extends the complementarity and sovereignty principles we were just discussing. They argue that Israel possesses a fiercely independent, highly functional judiciary capable of investigating its own military.
Right. So the unwilling or unable test fails, in their view.
Exactly. Therefore, any ICC intervention is seen as fundamentally illegitimate and indicative of a profound institutional bias. So protecting Israel from the court becomes a direct extension of protecting American national security interests.
But this puts Europe in a brutal diplomatic bind, because many European nations are massive financial contributors to the ICC, and they view it as a triumph of their diplomatic legacy. So how do they navigate this?
Well, it's incredibly tense. The European stance is rooted in the principle that justice must be blind. For European allies, the credibility of the international legal system depends entirely on its willingness to investigate any credible allegation, regardless of geopolitical alliances.
No exceptions for France.
Right. They argue that if you grant an exemption to a democracy simply because it is a close ally of the United States, you fatally compromise the court's moral authority.
So it forces a direct diplomatic collision. The U.S. is essentially making it a condition of the alliance that European nations help stifle the court. How does that pressure actually manifest behind closed doors?
It manifests in the freezing of mutual legal assistance treaties, or MLTs. It heavily impacts intelligence sharing and diplomatic coordination.
Wow, so it bleeds into everything.
Everything. The U.S. can apply immense pressure on European capitals to defund specific ICC initiatives, or to vote against the court in the U.N. General Assembly, or even to refuse to execute arrest warrants.
Which puts them in a terrible position. Sure.
Exactly. It creates a dynamic where European diplomats are constantly forced to choose between maintaining friction-free relations with Washington and upholding their own treaty obligations under the Rome Statute.
Okay, so we've mapped the legal arguments, the historical context of the ASMPA, and this massive diplomatic friction surrounding Israel. But whenever we see a government drop a headline-grabbing, earth-shattering policy announcement like dismantling an international court, we have to ask a very cynical but totally necessary question.
Right. Why now?
Exactly. Why today? Why July 14th, 2026?
Right.
Because in the ecosystem of global politics, timing is a weapon.
It absolutely is. Which brings us to one of the most fascinating analytical sections of the dossier. The text introduces what it calls the Buxema flighter theory.
A lightning rod.
Right, a red herring.
The media cycle manipulation theory. I find this endlessly intriguing. So the theory posits that the administration is intentionally using this explosive confrontation with the ICC to saturate the news cycle and distract the public from a much more dangerous, economically damaging crisis.
Oh, sure.
An escalating conflict with Iran.
Yeah. And to understand the mechanics of this theory, we really have to look at the psychology of domestic political consumption.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, a brewing war or a severe economic crisis involving Iran translates immediately to public anxiety. It means spiking oil prices, inflation, and the potential deployment of American forces.
Things people feel at the grocery store and the gas pump.
Exactly. Those are issues that directly impact voter behavior and create intense political vulnerability for any administration.
So how do you control that narrative? You flood the zone.
Yes.
You take a controversial but fundamentally established U.S. position, like this animosity toward the ICC, and you dramatically escalate the rhetoric. You announce active dismantlement, and you threaten sanctions on judges. And suddenly, every geopolitical analyst, every news network, and every op-ed columnist is debating the nuances of the Rome Statute, national sovereignty, and the legacy of the Hague Invasion Act.
The strategy relies entirely on displacing a complex, anxiety-inducing economic story with a highly polarized, ideologically clean story.
Because it's an easier fight to have.
Exactly. The debate over sovereignty and international law plays directly to the administration's base. It rallies support around the concept of America first and protecting military personnel. It is a brilliant, albeit cynical, application of media theory.
But, and this is important, the dossier applies a very strict analytical filter here. It doesn't present this red herring theory as gospel, right?
No, it exercises rigorous historical restraint. The text explicitly notes that while the Buxema flighter theory perfectly aligns with known tactics of narrative management, it remains an analytical speculation.
Right, we don't have the smoking gun.
Right. We do not have declassified National Security Council memos confirming a coordinated strategy to bury the Iran news with the ICC announcement.
And as analysts, it's crucial for us to hold two thoughts simultaneously. Governments are massive bureaucracies with competing factions. The State Department and the Pentagon might genuinely, deeply want to cripple the ICC based on all the ideological and security arguments we discussed earlier. And the White House communications team might simultaneously recognize the immense value of dropping that announcement on a day when the Iran crisis is peaking.
Multiple truths operate concurrently. The motive for the timing might be a calculated distraction, but the policy itself, the sanctions, the diplomatic pressure, the withdrawal of cooperation that is a tangible reality with immediate severe geopolitical consequences, the motive almost becomes secondary to the impact.
So let's talk about that impact. If the United States actually follows through on this July 2026 announcement, if they successfully weaponize their financial and diplomatic power to break the operational capacity of the International Criminal Court, the ripples are going to be catastrophic for the current global order.
Absolutely.
The dossier outlines several specific consequences, starting with the transatlantic relationship.
The structural strain on U.S.-European cooperation here just cannot be overstated. Europe views the post-WWI human rights architecture as a fundamental pillar of its identity. Yep. So if Washington actively attempts to destroy the apex core of that architecture, it creates a profound values gap.
It's not just a disagreement over a trade tariff. It's a fundamental rupture in how the two blocs view the rule of law itself. So how does that practically affect day-to-day governance?
It bleeds into every facet of bilateral relations. When trust in shared legal frameworks erodes, cooperation on totally unrelated issues becomes incredibly difficult.
Huh?
Extradition treaties are suddenly questioned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Joint task forces on counterterrorism or cybersecurity face these massive bureaucratic hurdles because European legal systems may restrict cooperation with a nation that actively undermines international judicial bodies. The diplomatic friction acts as a massive tax on the entire alliance.
And then there is the broader institutional fallout. If the ICC can be bullied into submission by targeted U.S. sanctions, it sends a chilling signal about the fragility of every international institution. Like, does the World Trade Organization hold any real power? Does the UN Human Rights Council mean anything?
It establishes a precedent that international law is merely a suggestion for superpowers. And that leads directly to the domino effect you often see debated in diplomatic circles. The primary fear among defenders of the court is how this rhetoric will be weaponized by authoritarian regimes.
Right. If I'm a dictator currently committing horrific abuses against my own population, and the ICC announces an investigation into me, this U.S. policy gives me the ultimate geopolitical get-out-of-jail-free card.
Exactly. You just use their script.
I just copy-paste the American talking points.
Yeah, yeah.
You have no jurisdiction. This is a violation of my sovereign constitution. Your judges are politically motivated and lack democratic accountability.
Yeah.
I mean, if the architect of the international order says the court is illegitimate, why shouldn't every tyrant on earth claim the same immunity?
That is the most immediate pressing danger. It emboldens bad actors and provides them with a highly sophisticated pre-packaged legal vocabulary to deflect accountability. However, the dossier does provide a critical piece of nuance here. It is too simplistic to frame the anxiety surrounding the ICC purely as a binary between law-abiding democracies and lawless dictatorships.
Unpack that for us, because the narrative is almost always framed exactly that way. The good guys want rules, the bad guys want impunity.
Right. But the reality is far murkier. The text points out that even many democratic nation states with very strong internal human rights records harbor legitimate, lingering anxieties about the scope and trajectory of the ICC.
Like what?
There are deep concerns within diplomatic circles about prosecutorial overreach, the potential for politically motivated indictments, and the fact that the court has historically focused disproportionately on the global South while struggling to hold powerful Western nations to account.
So the American skepticism isn't entirely isolated. They're just the only ones wielding a sledgehammer instead of a scalpel.
Exactly. The danger isn't just that authoritarian states will exploit the U.S. position. It is that other democracies, observing the U.S. withdrawal, may also lose faith in the universality of the system. They may conclude that the grand experiment of the Rome Statute is just structurally flawed and begin to quietly withdraw their own cooperation.
Which paints a very grim picture for the future. If this policy holds and the U.S. successfully cripples the court, what does the geopolitical landscape look like in, say, 2030 or 2035?
If the post-WWII system of universal accountability fractures entirely, we are likely looking at a regression to a highly fragmented, multipolar world dominated by regional blocs. We move away from the concept of universal human rights and return to spheres of influence.
A world where justice is entirely dependent on your geography and your alliances.
Yes.
If you commit a crime within the European sphere, the European rules apply. If you are under the American or Chinese security umbrella, you are effectively immune from any oversight outside your own capital.
It is a return to classic 19th century realpolitik. Might makes right. Power becomes the only law that genuinely matters, and the concept of an international community bound by a shared legal code becomes little more than a historical footnote.
Wow. That is an incredibly heavy reality to process. We have covered an immense amount of ground today, peeling back the layers of a policy announcement that fundamentally alters the global landscape.
It really does.
We started by dissecting the brutal mechanics of the July 2026 announcement, exploring how targeted financial sanctions are being weaponized against the judicial machinery of the ICC. We anchored that aggression in history, looking at the 2002 Hague Invasion Act and the longstanding bipartisan American anxiety over foreign jurisdiction. We dove deep into the philosophical clash. The American constitutional defense of sovereignty, complementarity, and democratic accountability, directly conflicting with the international law defense of universal justice and a rules-based global order.
And we looked at the real-world applications of that clash.
Exactly. We examined how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict acts as an accelerant for this friction, forcing European allies to navigate an impossible diplomatic tightrope. And of course, we analyzed the cynical brilliance of the Blixema-Fleiter theory, weighing the possibility that this entire crisis was perfectly timed to distract a domestic audience from the economic fallout of a brewing war with Iran.
The dossier's analysis of this event perfectly encapsulates how a single shift in legal philosophy at the superpower level cascades downward, threatening to rewrite the rules of global governance for an entire generation.
And if you found this deep dive into the fracturing of the transatlantic legal consensus fascinating, our next exploration is going to be essential listening.
Oh, definitely.
Next time, we are opening Chapter 9 of the Trump dossier. We will be looking at the rapidly changing, increasingly hostile economic and security relationship between Europe and the United States. If the U.S. is willing to tear down the institutions Europe holds dearest, what happens to the alliance itself? We are going to find out.
It promises to be a complex and, frankly, highly revealing discussion.
But before we wrap up today, we always want to leave you with something to chew on, something to ponder as you watch the news cycle spin this evening. We've spent this entire time dissecting the intricate legal and diplomatic rules of the international system.
Right. Consider this. The international legal system was built on a promise of universality. But if the ultimate enforcer and primary architect of the post-WWII order the United States officially declares and functionally proves that it is entirely immune from that order's highest court, does international law actually exist in any meaningful way? Or has this July 2026 announcement simply forced the world to admit that international law is nothing more than a polite gentleman's agreement, a set of rules strictly enforced upon the weak, but entirely optional for the strong?
Keep your eyes on the headlines, question the timing of the narrative, and we will see you next time on The Deep Dive.